a ridiculously hard time with the Xerox machine, so Laura's going to bring poems for you to write on for your first paper, which is due a week from today. And a couple of people are zooming in, so I just have to do a week from today. Are you shocked?
No.
Good. You love that? Yay. Is anyone shocked?
No, do we know what's on?
What?
Do we know the instructions?
You will once she brings the poems. Okay, let me just let people in. Sumaya, for sure. Yeah, I don't know why it does this. It tells you that people are waiting to be let in, but then when you actually go on it, maybe she's not on the right one. Oh, no, there she is. Good. Okay, hi.
Hello.
So I'm just going to set you up so you can see the class, okay? Can you hear well?
Yeah, I can.
All right. Yeah, so anyhow, the idea is there's going to be another handout. It'll be probably take about 10 minutes to get here. I will also send it via Latte. And what it is, I'm trying to save paper, obviously. Also, I have to say there's this thing about no electronic devices. So I know you can multitask, but just blame me, because I can't. And so when I see electronic devices, what happens is my brain says, look, there are electronic devices, and then I can't think about anything else. So it's all my fault. I know you all are great at it, and it's fine, and you can like shop and go on Discord and do all the stuff that you do, but people of my generation, we just see these things here and it's like our brain freezes. So it's all my fault. Good. No, those are two of many. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to send these out as attachments on Latte as well, but bring in the paper versions because that way you don't have to be on your devices, which would be good, because that way I can pay attention. Okay. There's also, what is it, Bookface? Yes, that was a joke.
Sorry.
Facebook, you all are like, you don't use Facebook as much as our generation does, actually.
No.
Facebook is definitely, it's like, okay, Facebook. All right, or Meta, or whatever you want to call it. So speaking about Meta, that's one of the things that we do when we're talking about poetry. So one thing, I've indicated this already, but let me re-indicate it, is any time you're doing a close reading of a poem, and what your assignment for a week from today is going to be is a close reading of a poem. I'm going to give you a choice of a bunch, both via handout and via attachment. Pick one. But what we've been doing in this class throughout, one thing that is different, in some ways it's similar, but let's talk about the differences here. One thing that's different about poetry from other literary forms or just other linguistic forms of discourse. We already talked about what Roman Jakobson says, which is that poetry pays attention to its own message. It's focused on the message. A way of putting that is to say that is that poetry always has, since I brought up Facebook, always has a meta element to it. That is, that a poem is, whatever else it's about, it's also about the fact that it's a poem. if you didn't know what a poem was and someone gave you a poem, you would be baffled by it. Not baffled necessarily by what it says, probably not. In most poems, it's just saying something. Roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, and so are you. Fine, it's saying something. That's a nice thing that you said to me. But why did you put what's really only about 25 words into four different lines? That was weird. Why don't you just write it out like the way you would? So the first way, and this is what we were talking about last class, the first way, at least visually, that you know you are dealing with a poem is that you have, in 99.9% of cases, a non-right justified margin. The right-hand margin of a poem is ragged. One poet said, you can tell if you open up a book at random, it's in another language, you don't even know what it is, and it's got a ragged right-hand margin, that means either that it's a book of poems or that it's a cookbook, because cookbooks list ingredients. So, and then you can say, oh, look, cookbook, it rhymes, like book face or whatever it is that you spend all your time doing. It rhymes. So that's poetry too. But poems are always, whatever else they are, they're about the fact, they pay attention to the fact that they're poems. They make you look for certain kinds of moves that they're going to make, which will be relevant to whatever it is that they're saying, but that will also get you to pay attention to things that you wouldn't pay attention to if they were in prose. And so what are you paying attention to? Well, again, to put it as a tautology, you're paying attention to the very fact that there are these poetic circuits that are being closed, that a line is ending after a certain number of feet, that the line ending is going to rhyme perhaps with another line ending, that there's an interaction which is not a meaningful interaction, by which I mean not that it's not important, but it's not an interaction which is conveying meaning first and foremost, but rather it's conveying something maybe that you could say is necessary to meaning, and it's intensifying it. And what is necessary to meaning and that poetry is intensifying is something like an expectation. That is, if someone starts talking to you, you expect that they have a reason to do it. This is just in everyday life. If someone comes up to you on the street and looks at you and they're about to speak, you assume they're going to ask a question, or they're going to say, you don't remember me, but we're book face friends, or whatever it is you all call it. Okay, I'll stop with that stupid joke. That's not even a dad joke. That's like a great granddad joke. You expect that there's a certain number of next moves. And that experience of expectation, that's just an experience of human communication, that someone starts saying something and you expect that it's going to go somewhere. Does anyone know what a garden path sentence is? Do you know that term? Okay, so a garden path sentence, this is just an easy example for general human communication. If I say the word garden path, what's the kind of context that you would hear that in when you're not talking about an actual garden path? What does it mean to be led down the garden path? Anyone know?
Be provoked by something?
No, not so much to be provoked by.
But led on.
Led on, yeah. Tricked. So led down the garden path to my own destruction, something like that. So that's a little melodramatic, but what a garden path sentence is a sentence that you think you're being led in one place, but it turns out that suddenly you're lost. So a typical garden path sentence is... Okay, so far so good, right? What Hemingway title might this be?
Old Man and the Sea.
Right, but it's not. So the old man... Yeah, that's a full sentence, subject and predicate.
Oh. Don't you need a verb?
No, it's got a verb.
Is Yeah.
Man is the verb.
Yeah. What is
so the young will have to distribute refreshments. What are the old going to do? Oh, the old, they man the boat. They're the ones who are running the boat. So the old man the boat. That's called a garden path sentence because most people have the response that you do, which is to say, where's the verb? What do you mean? The old man, yeah, what about it? The old man, the boat brought back after he'd lost the shark was never the same again. Something like that would work. So you think there's something missing. The old man, the boat brought back, complained that he was seasick. Okay, does that sentence make sense to people? The old man, the boat brought back, complained he was seasick. But it turns out, no, the sentence ends, boom! The old man, the boat. Another famous one is the horse, here, let me write it down. Sorry, Sumaya, you can't see this, but, the horse,
This is your copy.
Thank you.
And I have to do them all over again.
Oh, no!
The machine screwed up. And then...
What did it do?
It screwed up.
It looks okay.
Yeah. No, this is identity over again.
Oh, but shit. Okay.
The thing is that I'm not sure they're collated.
Okay, don't worry. We'll deal.
So it's divided into two
gotcha.
Parts.
Yeah, I can see.
Okay, there's one. And then there's three, and then I think it goes back to one.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We were just talking about book face.
What?
We were just talking about Bookface. You know that website?
No, I don't.
Facebook.
Oh. Okay.
Lame joke.
Have a good time.
All right. The horse raced by the someone read that?
Raced by the barn fell. But a fell is an animal, isn't it?
No, a fell is an adjective that means evil, like you and your fell doings trying to claim that Biden won the election. Fell is an adjective, but not here.
The horse ran by the barn fell.
No, this is no punctuation. This is the whole sentence without punctuation. And it's not ran, it's raced. So can you make sense of it? It's like the old man, the boat. How about the horse taken by the barn neighed? Does that work? The horse taken by the barn neighed. So, this person didn't just take the horse by the barn, she raced it by the barn. So the horse that was raced by the barn fell because it was raced too hard and it collapsed. Okay, does it make sense now? So the horse raced by the barn fell. Who raced by the barn? Some jockey. What did jockey do? Raced the horse by the barn. And what happened to that horse? Which one? The horse raced by the barn. Oh, the horse raced by the barn? That horse fell. Okay, so you can make sense of it. But it's a garden, it's called a garden path sentence. Linguists are really interested in this. It's called a garden path sentence because we have slotted the words in the wrong place in our minds, and an expectation that we have seems not to be met. So the old man, the boat, yeah, what? No, that's a whole sentence. That's what I'm saying. The old man, the boat. The horse, which horse? The one raced by the barn. What happened to that horse? It fell. So we have expectations. Another one is, you know, time flies like an arrow. You all know that, right? Maybe not in class when you are looking at your watches if you're not allowed to look at your electronic devices. Fruit flies like a banana. So what's the joke? Do bananas fly?
No, but they like it. Bananas.
Yeah, fruit flies, Drosophila. They really like bananas. So time flies like an arrow. You're expecting a parallel. Fruit flies like, I don't know, an airplane. But no, it's fruit flies. They like bananas. So every word in the apparently parallel sentence is being used differently. Fruit, time is a noun. What is fruit in fruit flies like a banana? It's an adjective. Flies is a verb. Time flies like an arrow. What's flies in fruit flies like a banana? A noun. Time flies like what part of speech?
Is it a simile or?
It is a simile, but what part of speech is it? It's a preposition. So time flies like an arrow. Fruit flies like what part of speech? A verb. Yeah, so time flies like an arrow. Fruit flies like a banana. Yeah, okay, you get nouns at the end. So those two things are the same, but otherwise they're all different. And what happens is you are in one groove and there's a different groove that you have to jump into to understand what the sentence means. But what all this shows is that poetry is especially, wait for it, groovy. Because you have grooves that have to do with expecting meter, expecting line endings, expecting rhyme, expecting various kinds of connections that are not semantic. That is, they're not about the meanings of words that are making the connections, but rather other aspects of language. But any language at all is always going to have a meta aspect to it. Any human interaction in language is going to have a meta aspect to it, which is that you will expect that if there's a subject, the old man, there will be a predicate. The old man wept when he finally made it home. And we can tell that we have those expectations when they get violated. That's how you know you have an expectation. It's when it's violated. When you have to do a double take. When you miss a step. When you're walking down a flight of stairs or something like that. You thought there was a step there. You've all had that experience. You thought there was one more step and there wasn't. And that's hard. It should be easy because you don't even have to go down one more step. You're already on level ground, but it's hard. So we're always prepped, and this is especially true in language. We're waiting for the end of the sentence, for the question, for the verb that comes after the subject, whatever. But there are certain things that we're waiting for, and the beginning of a sentence already starts constructing its ending. So when a sentence starts, we are expecting it to
end.
Yeah, or go somewhere or get to the place that it was pointed to. But all of those things are roughly in the same region. So poetry really focuses you on that and makes you more aware of it. And it does it primarily because there's this other thing that happens in poetry, which is that lines end. So it's not only that sentences end, it's that lines end. And so we are focused on line endings in a way that we're not when we're reading prose, and that we're not when we're hearing prose. So again, to go back to what it means to hear poetry, is you're focused on line endings because you're focused on the rhyme. You're waiting for the rhyme to come. Or you're just waiting for that invariable combination of a word ending with a foot ending. So this is, again, a little more subtle, which is why I'm repeating it. But the invariable combination that the word and the foot will always end at the same place in iambic pentameter every 5 feet. That after you get 5 feet, word endings can be anywhere in those 5 feet, except on the fifth one, they're going to hook up. They're going to join, and the word and the foot ending will be the same. And just to simplify a little bit, because this is not true of some poetry, but it's more or less true. Some poetry has other rules as well. When the foot ending, and the only place that you can guarantee that the foot ending will be a word ending will be the end of a line. And you all know, you've all had this experience, right? You're waiting for someone and they're late and you just cannot stand it. It's been like they've kept you waiting for 12 minutes or something, and you are basically going to lose it if they don't show up in the next 2 seconds. And then they don't. And then what happens is you do a kind of reset, which is, you know, you're furious, but then there's a kind of reset where you give them another minute before you get furious again. It's not like you just get furiouser and furiouser, to make an Alice in Wonderland joke allusion. You know what Alice says? Rhymes with furiouser and furiouser.
Curiouser and curiouser?
Yeah. Did you know that, or were you just looking for rhymes?
I might have known that at one point, but I just based on the rhyme.
Yeah, okay. So curiouser and curiouser is something that Alice says. But yeah, you get furiouser and furiouser. You know, where are they? And you're just about to lose it and they don't come. And then you reset. And then you get even more about to lose it a couple of minutes later. But you do have this couple of minutes where, all right. Or, you know, there's someone is drilling outside your window and you're trying to get to sleep and you are just going to absolutely go bonkers if it doesn't stop now. And then it doesn't. And then you reset when you're going to go bonkers, right? Is this a familiar psychological experience everyone has had? That's also the experience of a poetic line. That is not that you're going to go bonkers, but, well, that may be. But that you get to the end of the line and then there's a reset. And it is that experience of expecting some kind of resolution, and then beyond that, expecting that you're going to reset the very thing that you have been waiting for. That rhythm of getting to a resolution when word and foot ending are the same, when you get a rhyme, sometimes when you get an end stop, but that moment where everything that the poem is doing will come together, and then you reset. And these different kind of counterpoint experiences of heading towards a conclusion get reset, and then you experience again these multiple pathways that get to finally the same last syllable. So it's the last syllable. When a line gets to its last syllable, that is when everything comes together, when everything fits together, when everything clicks. That's the experience. And obviously, as we've already seen, poets will play with that experience in tons and tons of different ways. But that's the experience that you're having when you're reading a poem. So the way Cummings plays with it is rather different from the way John Milton plays with it. Although Cummings does have a poem which alludes to John Milton. He has a poem. I don't think we said this yet, but we'll be reading some Milton later. Milton says, some of you will know what he says his task is at the beginning of Paradise Lost. He's going to assert eternal providence, that to the height of this great argument, I may assert eternal providence and justify... Yeah, but no. Or something is right. Yeah. So that I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. So what he says he's going to try to do in this poem is prove that God is not evil, which he thinks is going to be a hard sell. But that is what he declares his purpose is, that to the height of this great argument, I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. So the poet A. E. Housman makes a little joke of that when he says you should be drunk all the time, and he says malt, that is the ingredient for scotch and for beer, and malt does more than ever Milton can to justify the ways of God to
man.
Yeah. So, and then E. Cummings's version, a little bit more pious, it's not about why you should drink all the time, is when any mortal, even the most odd, can justify the ways of man to
God,
I'll think it's strange that any normal mortal cannot justify the ways of God to
man.
Yeah, so that's a line that really struck with people, and so here are three examples of how the line ending is what you're expecting, partly because it's famous, because you know it. There's a little bit of a limerick feel to it. If there once was a man from Nantucket, you know where it's going. It'll drop in a bucket. And you're just waiting for that last word. That's actually not the last word of the poem. Last two words of the poem. So there's something you're waiting for, but you know you're waiting for it. And poems make you know what you're waiting for a whole lot more than other forms, because you know when the word is coming, and you often know that it's going to rhyme. So you're waiting for a word. You may know the actual word that you're waiting for, but certainly you know what the end part of that word is going to be. Often danger yet alive, we have come to 35, may much better years arrive, etc. You're waiting for that sound, and you may not know whether it's going to be thrive or strive or drive or dive, but you do know that it's going to be I've. And you also know when it's going to show up. So all of that is just part of the experiencing, part of the experience that you have with poetry, of the fact that it's a poem. The fact that something is a poem is as important a fact about what it means as any of the actual things that it says are. That's the crucial thing. So all poems are meta. That is the dictum. Every poem is in part, not in whole, but in part, about the fact that it's a poem. Okay. Here, so let me distribute this. So I'm not quite sure what she was saying, but I thought she screwed up. But it's... All right, yeah. So there are two sheets coming around. I think that's what's working. Yes. Oh, that's what she did. Okay, two sheets coming around. Sheet number one. Oh, I did it again. Okay, we'll do it this way. Sheet number two. Don't even know why I did that. Okay, sheet number one has a one on the top right-hand corner. Sheet number two, yeah, has a three on the top right corner. So you should have two sheets. The first, sheet number one, has two pages like this. Those are just poems to bring in if we don't get to them today, and poems we're going to talk about. Starting from the second side of that, that is the one that says number two on the second side, this is your assignment. Write on one of the following poems. I need one of those back. All right. Yeah, it's okay. It's all right. They'll come around. So the poems are that you can write on for a week from today. You should write a five-page paper. By five pages, I mean 1,250 words. So it can be less than five pages as long as it's that number of words. Or the poem by Ishmael Reed called Beware, Do Not Read This Poem. You could do that. You could do the poem by George Herbert called Denial. You can do, I forget the order I put them in. What's the next one?
I don't have a sheet.
Yeah, no, it's...
Pink Dog or Big Bird?
Yeah, good, thank you. Pink Dog by Elizabeth Bishop. Thank you. After Apple Picking by Robert Frost.
In the Wake.
In the Wake.
By Portia.
Yep. And how many people saw her yesterday? Yeah. Okay. There's some good poets who are reading at Brandeis this semester. Did you like her reading?
Yeah.
Another poet, a poem of whose we will do is coming, I think, in October. Alicia Stallings, A.E. Stallings. Or the poem called Christmas Tree by James Merrill. And so what you want to do in your papers is not just say what the poem's about. So let me remind you, do not do any outside research at all. Zilch, zero. Don't go to Wikipedia. Don't figure anything out that you don't already know about the poems or poets that we're doing. You know, it's fine. You may know a bunch about Robert Frost. You may know, is anyone in her class? All right, so you may know something about a bunch of these poets. That's fine, just don't find out more. And especially, but I'm not saying especially so that you can say, well, he didn't mean the first part as much, because I do. But also, especially, don't read up on these poems. So the point is for you to think about these poems yourself and to write about them as from the point of view of poetic form. That is the stuff that we've been talking about so far in this class, in the first 3 weeks or 3.5 weeks of this class. Yeah.
Any of the poems about the one on the first page?
Yeah, so the two poems on the first page are what we're going to talk about either today or next week. Yeah.
There's six in total.
Yes. Oh. So Christmas Tree, In the Wake, Pink Dog, After Apple Picking, Beware, Do Not Read This Poem, and Denial.
Perfect.
Okay, so not... A Slumber Did My Spirit Seal, not the Wyatt poem that begins, They Flee From Me, and not the Pope selection from the Essay on Criticism. So not those three, but I just wanted to save a little paper. Okay, so is that clear to people? And what you want to write about, whatever else you write about, you want to write about the form or formal qualities of these poems, about a way to put this. This is putting it maybe a little bit too slightly misleadingly, but just to give you a sense of what I mean, write about the white spaces. That is, write about the ways in which these poems would be different if they were laid out as standard prose. If you did automatic rapping and automatic kerning and so on, what would be lost? So that's not all that they're about, or that's not the only thing to say, because you should pay attention to things like meter and rhyme. But one of the things that I've been saying is that meter and rhyme, when printed, will require the white spaces. That is, that a line ending on a printed, when you're reading a poem, lines end where the rhymes are. So one way you can put this is that for a literate culture, we hear what we describe as a line ending because we are thinking of what a printed poem looks like or what a written poem looks like. For an oral culture, and I think you get a sense of this if you just listen to songs on official videos of songs or listen to hip hop or something like that. For an oral culture, you're not thinking what you would think is when these things are printed. What's being printed is just the kinds of things that you're hearing. But it's not that you're hearing, oh, that's a line ending, I get it. What you're hearing is just hit a mark, hit a mark, hit a mark. And so it doesn't matter which way you put it, whether you've hit a mark or whether you're seeing a line ending. But some poems, like Cummings so far has been our most obvious and most extreme version of this, is about seeing the letters on the page, whereas ballads, even though we're reading them, they're about hearing the ends, hearing just where the rhymes are, hearing dialogue, for example. And then sometimes, as in We Real Cool, there's a really interesting interaction between where you're hearing a line ending and where you're seeing it. So did people watch her? The YouTube link I sent you of Gwendolyn Brooks reading We Real Cool? Okay, you should, it's great. She also complains about the fact that it's her most famous poem. Not that she's disowning it, but she wrote a lot of really, really great poems, and that's the one that everyone remembers, and she's got mixed feelings about that. But you should definitely watch it. But again, you know, I gave you my lame version of it, of what she does. But what she does is she makes the we sound like the end of the line, which is how it's printed as well. And the rhymes, therefore, are kind of overridden. They're very prominent, and yet they're simultaneously being overridden. And it's those interactions that are part of the fabric, part of the texture of the poem. And so when you look at these, whichever one you do, there is going to be something interesting about the way the poem is structured. And it's the structure that I want you to write your paper on. Not just, oh, it's got this structure, look, it's got short lines and long lines, that's its structure, the end. But rather, why that structure works for the poem. And again, just to be clear here, structure most obviously might mean what it looks like on the page. So that, to go back to Easter wings, which was in the first handout, it looks like two pairs of wings. So fine, that's an obvious example of structure. But structure might also include not what it looks like, but what it sounds like, how expectations are set up and either met or deferred. So you're waiting for something and you don't get it. Or you're not waiting for something and it hits you and you realize that, oh, the sentence is over, the old man, the boat. Ah, I was waiting for something else and it didn't come, because that's the whole sentence. So structure meaning that there's a series of expectations that you have that get intensified by the fact that it's a poem, and those expectations are going to be variously met. They're not going to be met like clockwork. The more clockwork a poem is, the more boring it is. So there is clockwork there, but the poem dances around the clockwork. And that's a way of talking about what it is to pay attention to in your paper. And then the other thing I would say is read through all the poems, and whichever one grabs you most, but definitely read through all of them. They're worth reading through. Whichever one grabs you the most, read it obsessively a whole lot of times before you start writing. Just really get into whichever one really grabs you. Okay, questions? Yeah.
You said 5 pages, right?
Yeah, 1,250 right. Words. 1,250 words.
Formatting doesn't really matter.
Like, no. No, it's not page numbers, it's words, word numbers.
How many words did you say?
1,250.
Like, is that like the minimum or like maximum?
Yes. Okay. No, it's basically that's what to aim for. Sure, so,
okay, yeah.
Yeah, you know, a standard deviation from 1,250. So if you write a 700-page paper, that's too long. And if you write a 700-word paper, that's too short.
Okay.
All right? Mm-hmm. So, 1,250 more or less. You've been doing this all your lives, right? No, you're laughing?
Also, she has to, print out, real paper?
No, you can send it to me as a doc file.
Okay.
Not a PDF. Okay. Do not send me a PDF. Word or you can send it as Google Doc, just not a PDF. You can, if you want to print it out, that's fine. But if you just want to send it as a doc file, do that.
And it would just be before class on Thursday?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you mean do you want till midnight on Thursday?
Well,
do people want till midnight a week from today? Or knowing yourself as well as you do?
I'll take it.
Yeah.
I want it till midnight.
Okay, because you know yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. So midnight a week from today. Okay, so 1 week, 7 hours, and 17 minutes from now.
I'm so nervous.
What did you say?
I'm so nervous, but I was messing around. I'm actually nervous.
All of these poems are, they're all interesting. I picked them because they're all interesting precisely in this way.
I'm just worried about getting wrong. Not like me thinking that, oh, this is an I am, but it's not. And you said I can't look it up, so I'm going to act like an idiot. Because I'm not going to, like, if I get it wrong, and I say, oh, this is so impactful, this is an I am, and it's a trophy, I'm going to look like an idiot, you know? So I'm a little worried about that. But.
Okay, so worried.
A little bit.
No, what is it?
Oh, a trophy.
Okay, so don't worry. Okay?
Yeah.
You assume it's a trochee unless it isn't. But that should be your default assumption. Okay, so one of the things that we're going to be getting to in this class is the way poems interact with each other. We've already done that a little bit by looking at The Nut Brown Maid, the ballad that we looked at the beginning of, as well as Ashbery's Fantasia on The Nut Brown Maid. One of the things that I think is going on with We Real Cool is that Brooks is responding to a very famous lyrical ballad by Wordsworth, which is on the same sheet as We Real Cool. It's the poem before it. Again, we're going to take our departure from ballads pretty soon, like really soon. We may do one more from Wordsworth. But this is a very famous one. And what would make me think, what might make you think, that Brooks is responding to this ballad?
Quick now.
What?
Like right now?
Like right now, okay. Yeah.
I guess the title.
Yes.
I'm looking at it, because it says 7, and that was a number mentioned in We Real Pool.
Yeah, it's 7 at the Golden Shovel. So why does she decide there's 7 pool players there? Maybe that's a way of putting it. There's the sheet that has Fantasia on the Nut Brown Maid on the upper left, right? So, and on the lower right of that sheet is We Real Cool. And just before We Real Cool, there's a poem by Wordsworth called We Are 7. And one thing you can notice, that's one of Wordsworth's most famous poems. One thing you can notice is that the only way you know that there are 7 pool players at the Golden Shovel is that she says so in the subtitle. Otherwise, it would be an indeterminate number, but no, it's 7. So that definitely alludes to one of Wordsworth's most famous poems that people used to have to memorize all the time, called We Are 7. Let's go through fairly quickly just to, because we've spent time on ballads and there's one other ballad that I want us to look at. But it's the narrator, the speaker. So is this something that you have had drilled into you before now, that you have to distinguish the speaker of a poem from the poet? Not drilled into you?
No.
Okay, so this is something that I'm glad, actually, because I think it's overly drilled into people to whom it's drilled into, is that the poet is not the speaker, that often you'll have a poem, if you talk about what the words of the poem are saying, you should say the speaker does this, the speaker thinks that, and so forth. A very famous example of that is a dramatic monologue called My Last Duchess by Robert Browning, which, you know it?
Yeah.
Do you remember how it begins?
No.
Okay.
It was right in high school, though. I wrote a paper on it. But...
All right. Well, we may do it in this class, too.
Okay.
So
I'd like to.
Yeah. So it's called My Last Duchess, and it begins, "That's my last duchess painted on the wall, looking as though she were alive." So it's spoken by a duke. But the poet, Robert Browning, is not a duke. And he wasn't married to a duchess. And certainly hadn't been married to a duchess who died. So the speaker is showing the addressee of his words a painting of his duchess who has died. And Robert Browning isn't doing that, and we are not seeing such a painting. So you distinguish between the speaker and the poet, as though what a poem is something from a piece of drama. As though what a poem is like, it's not Shakespeare who says to be or not to be, that is the question, it's Hamlet who says it. So people tend to push that idea really hard. Which, if you're a poet, you may think, yeah, but that's not what I'm doing when I'm writing poems. Most poets think that they're writing in their own voices, not oh, I am going to produce a speaker who is sad and in love and deep and thinks deep thoughts. I myself am happy and don't love anyone and am shallow and I only think shallow thoughts. But I'm going to write a poem in which the speaker of the poem is all those other things that I'm not. So if you're moved to write a poem, it's usually because you want to say something that matters to you and not to some speaker that you're inventing. So do people agree with this?
Yes.
All right, good. This, however, isn't quite that kind of poem. This is a poem in which the speaker is kind of an idiot. And that's part of the point of the poem. So the first stanza is, a simple child that lightly draws its breath and feels its life in every limb, what should it know of death? So there's that very typical antonymic rhyme. The child, what should it know of death? And then the speaker tells a little story. I met a little cottage girl. She was 8 years old, she said. Her hair was thick with many a curl that clustered round her head. She had a rustic woodland air, and she was wildly clad. Her eyes were fair and very fair. Her beauty made me glad. So the speaker is walking in the country, and he sees a little girl, and her innocence and her beauty. He's glad to see her. It's great. Sisters and brothers, little maid, how many may ye be? Asks the speaker. And she answers, again, here's a dialogue. How many? 7 in all, she said. Wordsworth would have pronounced that said. 7 in all, she said, and wondering, looked at me. What's the rhyme scheme?
A-B-A-B.
Yeah, A-B-A-B. And where are they, I pray you tell? So she's just alone in front of the cottage. So the speaker wants to know, where are the 6 sisters and brothers she has? So, and where are they, I pray you tell? She answered, 7 are we, and 2 of us at Conway dwell, so a town nearby, and 2 are gone to sea. 2 of us in the churchyard lie, my sister and my brother, and in the churchyard cottage, I dwell near them with my mother. So what is, just by way of practice, but it has an effect in the poem, brother and mother, what kind of rhyme is that? I don't mean give me a technical name. I mean, what is, what do you notice about that rhyme?
Familial rhyme.
Okay, it's familial rhyme. It's 2 words that are kind of like each other, brother and mother, family members, and their meaning is not so very different from each other. Obviously, it is, but not so very different. Brother rhyming with other would be more like breath and death. But brother rhyming with mother, that's bringing things together. What about I and lie? So notice brother and mother are nouns as well. What about I and lie? 2 of us in the churchyard lie, part of speech?
It's a verb.
And in the churchyard cottage, I dwell near them with my mother. I is a
pronoun. So I lie could be like, it actually is a sentence? No, it's not a sentence.
It can be, but it's not being used as a sentence here. It's just that some of the rhymes are like each other. Brother and mother are rhyming 2 words that are very much like each other. And 2 words that are not like each other, lie, which means what here?
Two.
Well, 2 of us in the churchyard lie, why?
They're dead.
They're dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas, and 2 of us, my sister and my brother, and in the churchyard cottage, I dwell near them with my mother. So there's a cottage near the churchyard, and that's where I live. And what's the difference between her and her sister and brother?
She's alive.
She's alive. And what do you think of having I as the last word of that line that way?
I still remain.
Okay, nice. It's like perched there. I'm still there. If you are reading over enjambment, that is, you don't pause when there's an enjambment, you would read it as, and here's again a question of how do you want to perform this mentally? Do you want to read, do you want to perform it as, two of us in the churchyard lie, my sister and my brother, and in the churchyard cottage, I dwell near them with my mother? Or do you want to mentally perform it as, two of us in the churchyard lie, my sister and my brother, and in the churchyard cottage, I dwell near them with my mother? Yeah, I think so. The rhyme is really prominent. That's a thing that giving prominence to rhymes does, is it tends to override enjambment. So there's a way in which we know that we're not supposed to pause, kind of, there isn't a pause of meaning at the end of the line, but there is a pause of rhyming. And it's almost as though she's perched there at the end of the line and the rhyme is giving her stability. So her sister and her brother are dead, but she is still there. And in the churchyard cottage, I dwell near them with my mother. He, the speaker, starts trying to correct her because he's mansplaining to her. He really is. This is like the first great mansplaining poem. And he says, "You say that two at Conway dwell and two are gone to sea, yet ye are seven? I pray you tell, sweet maid, how this may be." So how many does he think they are? Yeah, like, just do the math, girl. So then did the little maid reply, "Seven boys and girls are we. Two of us in the churchyard lie beneath the churchyard tree." So we are seven. Two of us lie in the churchyard. "You run about, my little maid." Can you imagine what a jerk would be telling this 8-year-old kid? No, do the math, because two of your siblings are dead. What's wrong with you? Do the math.
So at sea means dead, essentially?
No. So she has said before, two are gone to sea. So if you look, and where are they? "I pray you tell," she answered, "seven are we, and two of us at Conway dwell." So that's two of them.
Yeah.
"And two are gone to sea." That's four of them. And then there's her, that's five.
And then, the two dead.
And then they're the two dead.
Okay.
Yeah. So now he says, "But listen to what you just said." It's like he's cross-examining her in a legal thriller. "You say that two at Conway dwell and two are gone to sea. Yet ye are seven, I pray you, tell, sweet maid, how this may be." And then she says, "Then did the little maid reply, seven boys and girls are we. Two of us in the churchyard lie beneath the churchyard tree." Yeah, but look at you. You run about, my little maid. Your limbs, they are alive. What's going to rhyme with alive? Good. "If two are in the churchyard laid, then ye are only five." See, I proved it to you.
And that's kind of interesting. It's like alive and five. You kind of have this correspondence in this poem.
Right. Yeah. The alive ones are the five ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. "Their graves are green," she says. "They may be seen," the little maid replied, 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side." Okay, what's happened in the first and third lines of those stanzas? Something we noticed in The Nut Brown Maid as well.
The internal rhyme.
"Their graves are green, they may be seen," the little maid replied, 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. So why do you think you have those two lines of internal rhyming there? Okay, so look at that stanza and pick the words in the stanza that would be most likely to occur to you as an answer to the question. That's such a weird question, I know.
Graves are both seen in dream.
Okay, but just formally, what would you say when you have internal rhymes in a single line? Or even if you have words that rhyme, how can you tell that the two words rhyme?
Same last syllable.
Okay, same last syllable. But let's just say someone says to you, look at the first, a poem I didn't print out, I might have, would do this. Look at the first line of this poem, and now look 50 lines later at the last line of the poem. You just read the entire poem. Does the first rhyme line with the rhyme with the last? So how would you tell? Yeah, and but you know they're on separate pages. So what would you have to do? Yeah. Okay, you could remember it, but your memory is really bad. So what do you do? You write it down. What words do you write down? Of the first line and of the last line, right.
Yeah.
And so you write them down on a sheet of paper, and when you write them down on the sheet of paper, you write them down blank by blank.
Side by side?
Yes! I guess the payoff wasn't as good for you as I was hoping it was going to be. But yeah, look at that. And they are side by side. So when she's insisting on the other two siblings, the internal rhymes that she uses are examples of being side by side, you could say. The very phrase side by side is a phrase that describes itself. The words side by side in that phrase are side by side. So here, their graves are green, they may be seen. She's insisting on that side-by-sidedity of rhyme. The graves are green, they may be seen, the little maid replied. 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. Now again, Wordsworth never misses a trick. So a thing you might notice is that there's another number suddenly in this poem. What number?
12.
7
plus 5.
Nice. Okay, good. It's like the 18 O's in body. But also, she's actually turns out to be pretty good at counting. It's like, it's not that she's an idiot who doesn't know what he's saying. It's, yeah, 12 steps or more from my mother's door. I can give you a good estimation of how far away they're lying in the churchyard. 12 steps or more from my mother's door. A general rule in poetry, not a rule to be utterly certain of, but a general rule in poetry is that when you get words like steps or feet or meter, there's a self-referential aspect to them. Wordsworth, actually, Sir Philip Sidney has a poem which begins with "How sad steps thou climbest the sky." It's a poem to the moon. "With how sad steps thou climbest the sky." And Wordsworth writes another sonnet with the same first line, "With how sad steps thou climbest the sky." And the idea is that the steps of the poem, the feet of the poem as they alternate, the steps that a poem takes is in meter. So poets tend to be very attentive to words like steps. Milton, how many people know that Milton was blind?
He told us.
Yeah, I thought I did, but I wasn't sure. Or I was sure, I just want to know if you're paying attention. Yeah, that's it. That's a ticket. His last great poem is a poem about Samson, who was also, do people know? What happened to Samson?
I mean, didn't he tear down the...
Yeah, but before that.
His hair was cut.
His hair was cut, and he was blinded by the Philistines. So that poem, which is a drama, begins with Samson speaking to a young boy who's leading him around. And what he says is, "A little onward, guide my steps. In this dark world, a little further on." So, as you're reading the poem, it's almost as though the meter that you're tracking and following, you're also guiding Samson through the poem. Sorry, "A little onward, lend thy guiding hand to..." I misquoted it. "A little onward, lend thy guiding hand to these dark steps, a little further on." And in fact, it's almost as though he's saying, as you read the poem, because it wasn't meant for performance, it was only meant to be read, use your finger as you read the line. So, "A little onward, lend thy guiding hand to these dark steps, a little further on." And there's the enjambment, "to these dark steps, enjamb, a little further on." So, when she says 12 steps or more from my mother's door, what do you notice about that line, if anything? How does it compare to her other lines?
Is it 12 syllables?
Yeah, it's not 12 syllables, but it's longer. It would be great if it were 12 syllables.
Yeah.
That would be perfect. But yeah, it's longer. 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. So there they are. "My stockings there I often knit, my kerchief there I hem, and there upon the ground I sit and sing a song to them." So suddenly, who's the poet now? Yeah, it's like she's the poet, and I sing a song to them. Notice that Wordsworth has done something here which is similar to what happens in Proud Maisie, which is on the other side of that sheet, so just turn to it for a second. "Proud Maisie is in the wood, walking so early. Sweet Robin sits on the bush, singing so rarely. Tell me, thou bonny bird, when shall I marry me?" So it's a dialogue again. "Tell me, thou bonny bird, when shall I marry me? When six broad gentlemen kirkward shall carry ye," the bird responds. She responds to the bird, "Who makes the bridal bed? Birdie say truly." And then the bird responds to her, "The gray-headed sexton that delves the grave duly." And then what happens? No, she doesn't take over. The bird takes over. Yeah. Suddenly, what had been a back and forth dialogue becomes only the robin speaking. "The glowworm or graven stone shall light thee steady. The owl from the steeple sing, welcome, proud lady." So what had been a back and forth dialogue, now there's a kind of fatality that comes from the fact that it's the robin who is telling her what's going to happen, and she doesn't get another word in. And that gives you the feeling of fatality, of the fact that she's going to die. So this something not as intense, but something like that is happening with We Are Seven, which is 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. "Oh yes, my little cottage girl, but if they're side by side, then the fact that they are dead simply cannot be denied," is what you expect him to say. But no, now she takes over. "My stockings there I often knit, my kerchief there I hem, and there upon the ground I sit and sing a song to them, and often after sunset, sir, when it is light and fair, I take my little porringer and eat my supper there." That is basically a bowl for eating porridge in. And then more, the first that died was Sister Jane. In bed she moaning lay, till God released her of her pain, and then she went away. So that's a pretty amazing understatement. And then she went away. So in the churchyard she was laid, and when the grass was dry, together round her grave we played, my brother John and I. And when the ground was white with snow, and I could run and slide, my brother John was forced to go, and he lies by her side. So she's pretty amazing. Has he learned his lesson, do you think? How many are you then, said I. So, yeah, what a jerk. If they two are in heaven, quick was the little maid's reply, oh, master, we are seven. But they are dead, those two are dead, their spirits are in heaven. He just can't stand it that she can't do arithmetic. 'Twas throwing words away, for still the little maid would have her will and said, nay, we are seven. So, I think one cool thing about that is, first of all, that the speaker is represented by the poem as an idiot, who doesn't know that he's an idiot. And it's despite himself that she comes across as wonderfully as she does. And she is the one who understands death a whole lot better than he does. So he thinks death means you just take people off of the census. It's like he's a census taker and he's saying, so how many people, you know, I got to take it down. And she's saying, we're seven. And he says, I can't report that you're seven because two are dead. No, I'm going to put down five. But she is far deeper than that. And so in this dialogue, which is true over and over and over again of ballads, there's an uncanny voice and a kind of clueless, ordinary voice. And that's what we saw in Proud Maisie. To some extent, that's true of the Nut Brown Maid. That's definitely what we're seeing here. Correct.
Last stanza's five lines, too.
Yes.
I think that's kind of a joke a little bit, because I don't think any other stanza's five lines.
No, all the others are four lines.
Yeah, so it's kind of like...
So
I don't know what to call that, but...
Yeah, okay, so it's another formal moment of self-reflection on the poem's part. Not on the speaker's part, but on the poem's part.
Is that the type of thing we could write about? Or
yes!
Okay.
Yeah, totally. Look, just to give you an example, if you write about... where are they? So if you write about... I just want to give you something that is obvious. If you write about beware, do not read this poem, notice the spacings. So what you do with them might be interesting, but definitely notice them. It's really hard to get a copy of this poem that has the spacings right, but this one does. I actually spent an amazing amount of time trying to get you an accurate copy of the poem, because people are always putting this poem on the web and they're saying, oh yeah, this poem is so cool, but they don't get the spacings right. So tonight, space, comma, longer space, thriller was about an old woman, space, comma, shorter space, so vain she surrounded herself with, or W, many mirrors. So pay attention to that. I don't know what you'll do with it. I myself have several theories about the spacing, but I'm not sure that any of them is right. But notice stuff like that.
Would you like us to go chronologically if you were going to analyze spacing to start from top down?
Yeah, go through the poem. You don't have to say, oh yes, this poem is really good because it's a poem about space, and notice the second to last space is spaced differently. No.
Okay. Do
what we're doing in this class. That's the last thing to say. Do what we're doing in the class. Go through a poem. Okay. Yeah.
So we're just be like kind of like
longer are involved, but I'm just not like, thesis statement is, the spacing tells a lot about X.
Well, that could be the thesis statement, but it's kind of a throwaway thesis statement. That's like thesis statement as title. Yeah, what I'm going to talk about is spacing. Okay, let's start at the beginning. That's
and
fine.
Yeah, okay, so you just want to kind of like thought process and discussion of...
Yeah, but live with the poem for a couple of days before you start writing it.
Yeah.
Like, really get to know it. Live with it for a couple of days before you start writing
it.
Okay? Otherwise, it'll eat you up, this poem. We'll eat you up. Okay. Have a good Rosh Hashanah if you're celebrating, and see you a week from today.